The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And democracy is a beautiful thing, don't you agree? After that result in Iowa last night, the health of the Republican Party couldn't be better, right?
Yes. The energy is on our side.
That's an official of the Republican Party in South Carolina watching with bemusement as the campaign juggernaut moves from Iowa to points north, south, and east and west. We will have a few more words with him in just a moment. But first, some happy candidates.
Tonight is a testament to the people's commitments, to their yearnings to get back to our core commitments, free market principles, constitutional liberties, and the Judeo-Christian values that built this great nation.
That's Texas Senator Ted Cruz reveling in a victory in Iowa that has launched him into the front-runner status for a political nanosecond.
This is a time where we need a president that will truly preserve and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, not one that undermines, attacks, and ignores the Constitution of the United States.
It was Senator Marco Rubio's third-place finish that really may be the headline from Iowa. Does Rubio have the all-important momentum going into New Hampshire? Donald Trump certainly has the leading poll numbers in New Hampshire right now, but some wind came out of his sails last night, and whether Trump buys a farm in Iowa or not, you got to figure he's not coming back here anytime soon. But the other headline?
So as I stand here tonight, breathing a big sigh of relief, thank you, Iowa, I want you to know I will keep doing what I have done my entire life. I will keep standing up for you. I will keep fighting for you. I will always work to achieve the America that I believe in.
Right. But Hillary Clinton had to pull out every stop to force a draw in Iowa. If Bernie Sanders wins in New Hampshire next week, is this a rebellion within the Democratic Party?
As I think about what happened tonight, I think the people of Iowa have sent a very profound message to the political establishment, to the economic establishment, and by the way, to the media establishment.
Media establishment? Is he talking about me there? Raymond Buckley joins us now. He's chair of the New Hampshire Democratic Party. Mr. Buckley, welcome.
Thank you for having me, John.
Is this suddenly an all-out battle for the soul of the Democratic Party, and can Hillary be the comeback kid next week in New Hampshire?
Well, that's what makes this next 8 days so exciting here in New Hampshire. We have a reputation of deciding at the very last minute. In 2008, despite all of the work and efforts of the campaigns, nearly 20% of the voters decided on primary day who they were going to vote for. We have same-day voter registration. An unregistered person can wake up on primary morning saying, hey, I'm feeling the burn, or I'm ready to say Hill yes, whatever it is that they do. We've got 41% of our voters are independent. They can choose a Republican ballot or a Democratic ballot. That's what makes this the absolutely epicenter of the political world for the next 8 days.
This kills the momentum for Donald Trump. Yes, no.
Well, you just never know. New Hampshire voters, both on the Democratic side and Republican side, do always react to Iowa, but not necessarily always the same. So it could be a pretty interesting week for all of them. But the real loser is the Republican Party. When the majority of Iowa Republicans, who you know, are far to the right of the mainstream of America, their top three people, one suggested that we ban Muslims from America. Another one calling marriage equality one of America's darkest hours. And another says he opposes abortion, even the case of rape and incest. These are extremists. They're off to the far right. And I think it's going to be a good year for Democrats across the country. Especially
many
in New Hampshire.
Many people think Bernie Sanders is an extremist, and if he wins in New Hampshire, then it's really sort of the old progressives versus the mainstream Clinton Democrats. And I'm wondering how that's going to play between now and the convention.
Well, I think that's what's going to make this a very exciting race between Senator Sanders and Secretary Clinton. But the real difference that you're seeing is that it's a positive race between the two of our candidates, talking about a forward-thinking agenda versus the sort of brutal negative attacks that the Republicans and their super PACs are playing against each other, really appealing to the worst and the fears in their base.
No, and you can criticize the Republicans, and that's totally fine. But do you think Hillary Clinton should be worried this morning?
Any candidate who should not be worried when they're looking at the New Hampshire electorate, because we expect our candidates to do exactly what she and Bill Clinton understand, and that is working round the clock for the next 8 days. They're going to be crisscrossing the state. We've got CNN town hall meeting with the two candidates, tomorrow evening, then MSNBC debate, and then we've got a major event of the state party with thousands of New Hampshire Democrats. So we've got a great week ahead.
How many people are getting introduced to these candidates now? In other words, people in New Hampshire who haven't, you know, been paying much attention, how important are they?
It's critically important. The last poll that I saw just a day or so ago, 41% of New Hampshire Democrats, or likely New Hampshire Democratic primary voters, hadn't really made up their mind yet. So all of this polling that you're seeing, I don't think it's terribly relevant. I think that both campaigns have put on a terrific ground operation. In fact, each one of them individually has more staff and more offices open than all 13 Republican candidates combined. So this is going to serve us well for November here in New Hampshire. And I think they're going to build this sort of ground operation across the country.
Raymond Buckley is chair of the New Hampshire Democratic Party. Where are you speaking to me from?
Concord, New Hampshire, the state's capital.
Capital of New Hampshire, Concord, New Hampshire. Raymond Buckley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to return now to the voice you heard right at the beginning of this segment. Nsei Ekpo is second vice chair of the South Carolina Republican Party, and he says he's ready for anything after last night.
The energy from all the voters, on the Republican side at least, showed that we're in for quite a race.
And what happened to Trump, do you think?
I think Trump has no reason to hang his head. I'm sure he wouldn't say that because he likes to win and he likes to win big. But he's coming into untested waters. He's a neophyte politician, and he did very well. I just think that Senator Cruz had a better ground game using traditional politics and traditional get-out-the-votes methods. So an unorthodox campaign like Mr. Trump is running, you know, he did a great job to get it in second place, but I think at the end of the day, the system still holds where getting out the vote is the most important thing to securing a victory in this process.
Now, you make a good point. I mean, you got to do the ground game in Iowa, and Trump decided he wasn't going to do that, but he did remarkably well, and people watch the polls, but it's not about polls in Iowa.
Right, and I would say it's really not about polls nationwide. Winning the presidency is a state-by-state process, so national polls mean very little. It's about who can best mobilize their forces to come and show up and vote. And Senator Cruz just showed that with his digital ground game. A lot of people are comparing it to being as successful as Barack Obama's 2008 campaign when no one thought he would beat the mighty Hillary Clinton. It just goes to show that that is still the key metric that wins elections.
What are voters to make around the country of media characterizations of Marco Rubio now as the so-called mainstream candidate? How do they decode that, dismiss that? What's your reaction to that? Because that's what we're going to hear.
Yeah, I think it's great for Senator Rubio to have that mantle. I think there's a battle of, well, who do we coalesce around? Is it going to be Jeb Bush? Or is it going to be Marco Rubio? And Marco was fighting to get that more establishment, moderate mainstream Republican vote. So you're going to see a lot of jockeying. I don't think Jeb is out of the race. I think he's too much of a fighter deep down inside. And I don't think he will go quietly into that dark night. So we'll have to see how that holds. And I think actually South Carolina is going to be the test for that.
South Carolina is a test for Jeb Bush?
South Carolina, we really are a wild card state. You got to remember, in 2012, we chose Newt Gingrich to be the nominee. What I think is that this is going to be a four-way slugfest come February 20th on our primary, first in the South, between Mr. Trump, Mr. Cruz, Rubio, and Bush. And I think 17% for each of those candidates could be a very likely scenario, with the winner edging out by a percentage or two. And I think that will tell us a lot about the direction of this race.
It does seem as though that is a formula. Your four-way slugfest is a formula for a battered convention where everybody's damaged goods.
Well, that's one way to think about it, John. I think the other way to think about it is we have some strong, viable candidates, and each of these candidates are bringing their tribe to the table, so that whoever the eventual nominee is going to be, the other tribes are going to, you know, support that candidate, which is going to overall make us stronger, I thoroughly believe.
Well, but that assumes that the Trump tribe is going to, at some point, endorse a front runner. And if it's a four-way slugfest, it seems like Trump would be in it to win it.
Well, of course, and we're still early. But what I'm saying is, when we get to the nominating convention, there's got to be a winner. And at that point, we're not going to get 100%, but we're going to get some percentage of the other tribes to come support our candidate. I look at it this way. The energy, like I said in the opening statement, is really on the Republican side. You have, between Mr. Trump and Mr. Cruz, you have well over 50%. Almost approaching 60% of the voters in Iowa. Now, I know Iowa is just not representative of the United States particularly, but that says something. There's a lot of energy. There's an energy coefficient that I think will translate and hold over, much like we've seen in the last three elections with Republican victories in the House and in the Senate.
And all of a sudden, there's a big question mark above the head of the donkey that was so sure of what was going to happen in Iowa, and now it's anybody's guess. You want to comment on the Democrats?
Well, I think, you know, Bernie Sanders has tapped in to some energy there, and who's ever to carry the momentum forward is going to be the winner. And so I think it's really great for him. He's getting the millennial vote. The energy is clearly behind him, and we'll have to see how that goes going into New Hampshire, where I think he's ahead there. And then South Carolina, I think he's quite behind Senator Clinton, but it's a long race.
And Zay Ekpo is second vice chair of the South Carolina Republican Party, speaking to us from Greenville. Thanks so much, Ense.
Thank you.
And now, all of you Tuesday morning pundits, it's time to pay close attention to all of those men and women on the campaign trail behind the curtain. The true wizards of our oddball democracy. And Todd Zwillick takes us there.
You kind of don't want to show people what really goes on behind the scenes.
We should start by prepping the governor with Russian economic policy.
You can't count how many times I've been across this state.
You're the strategy guy.
But you're the body man.
I definitely carried a bag that's full of all the things that they could need.
I got coffee, I got ginseng, I got protein bars.
That's following them around with a camera, it's following them around with a microphone.
We need to hire an operative to do research, you see what I mean?
Just one poll. Those things aren't scientific.
Maybe politics isn't for you.
We have a campaign that we've got to win. You understand?
It's a series all this week we're calling Road Warriors, Life on the Campaign Trail. And long before a candidate ever jumps onto a stage to screaming crowds, long before an aspiring senator appears in front of hay bales or admiring a butter sculpture at the Iowa State Fair, the advance team is there to make sure everything goes exactly right. And that means that people like Charlie Pierce are in control days, sometimes weeks, ahead of the candidate. Charlie is a Republican advance man, and his job can mean anything from booking hotels to making sure the boss looks picture perfect in front of voters. He's worked on advance teams for Mitt Romney, for John McCain, and for Sarah Palin. And he says that advance has to think of everything that needs to go right, and especially everything that can go wrong.
So, you know, you start with trying to get your date, your location, what type of event it's going to be. And then once you get all that settled, you start moving into the the really mundane logistics of the event. You know, how many press are we expecting in attendance? And now you have to wire an internet and enough power, and you got to decide how big of a crowd you want. And then you go into your event setup. What do you want your tight shot to be? That's the picture right behind the candidate. That's 90% of the, what television cameras use. And then what the wide shot's going to look like. And is it enthusiastic? And do you have people behind them and flags behind them and the large campaign branding, whether it's the Believe in America slogan like we had or the new Romney logo with the specialty R. And then you get down to the, what's called the TikTok. So you walk through every second, every minute of Governor Romney's participation in the events.
Let's talk about when things go wrong, because they can. There is a Romney event that's kind of famous in political circles around Washington, and I'm sure Boston these days, about when he appeared in a football stadium in Detroit. Can you explain what happened from your perspective at that event?
To give you a little backstory, the RSVPs for the original venue they had for the Detroit Economic Club had just massively over exceeded what they were expecting. So the Detroit Economic Club heads wanted to switch it to doing the event on Ford's Field. Now, the optics of that, as our advance teams knew, were that while 1,500 people could fit in the field, that there's 50,000 or so fixed seats surrounding the stadium that we were not going to fill.
And so to be clear, Charlie Pierce, what happened was you had a shot from the field that made the candidate look like he was at a rally with 1,500 people, which is pretty good. But if you went up in the rafters, which reporters did, and took a picture, it looked like Mitt Romney in Michigan, his dad's home state, his home state, was speaking in front of an empty stadium.
Correct. And sometimes perception is reality. And just as a counter to that, neither could Barack Obama at this time in his in his presidency. Maybe in the hype of 08, he was filling stadiums. But during the DNC convention, they had to take it out of a big stadium, I believe, in Charlotte, which they claimed for weather, but was clearly because they couldn't get the people.
So I also want to talk about a time when things really seemed to go right for you. Now, when you were working for John McCain on his presidential campaign, you got tasked to do advance for his new vice presidential pick, somebody who was unknown, right?
Correct. Yeah, I was the vice presidential advance team was originally going to be more of a skeleton crew just to get whoever the vice presidential candidate was going to be to their fundraising events and just more second tier level presidential style campaign events. Obviously, with Governor Palin, her crowds required some top level advance guys. And I was fortunate enough to be at some unique moments in history as a site advance guy for her vice presidential announcement event, which was really exciting in Dayton, Ohio.
Governor Sarah Palin of the great state of Alaska.
And her UN trip to New York City during the UN General Assembly week.
Now let's listen to a clip from a famous interview that Governor Palin did with Katie Couric. This wound up being a famous exchange that you had something to do with. Listen.
It's very important when you consider even national security issues with Russia as Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States of America. Where do they go? It's Alaska. It's just right over the border.
Now, Charlie Pierce, that interview wound up to be very famous. It led to bits like this from Tina Fey.
Every morning when Alaskans wake up, one of the first things they do is look outside to see if there are any Russians hanging around. If there are, you got to go up to them and ask, what are you doing here? And if they can give you a good reason, they can, then it's our responsibility to say, you know, shoo, get back over there.
Now, from the campaign's perspective, that turned into sort of a comedy meme, except the sets were all sort of recreated in popular culture afterward.
Yeah, it was sort of bizarre, that room for the Katie Couric interview. It was actually surrounded by glass, so we had to bring in all this pipe and drape, and the team did a great job of really dressing it up. And then to a few days later to watch pretty much down to the flowers recreated on SNL was pretty interesting. And
now, you also had a candidate in Governor Palin who didn't have any foreign policy experience at the time. You all went to New York around a UN conference and made her look like somebody on the world scene.
Yeah, it's actually pretty simple. I mean, basically the format you want to use is that it's a tete-a-tete or a bilateral meeting. So it's Governor Palin looking like a head of state meeting with another head of state. The difficult part was we were basically using hotel rooms across New York City and conference areas to bring in flags to and then get these setups lit and staged right so that it looked like we were just holding a series of meetings in the UN, even though we were in 5 to 10 different places scattered across New York City, mostly hotels. So from an optical's perspective, that event was a big success for our advanced team.
But Charlie Pierce, let's talk about the downside of that. Do you ever have a concern that this takes something away from voters, that the showbiz of politics is an artifice that in a way is dishonest for any voter looking at a campaign?
You know, I don't think so. And I used to actually think about that. And part of it, the reason I had some trepidations about doing this interview, you kind of don't want to show people what really goes on behind the scenes, right? The sort of the pulling the curtain back on the Wizard of Oz that, oh, what's going on? But at the same time, I think voters actually appreciate that more. And you, especially in this cycle, you can tell people come out to these rallies. They want to be energized. They want to be, you know, excited by something. And the plain fact of the logistical matter is you can't travel between city and city with 120 press following you and just have a casual conversation with a voter. It's just a logistical impossibility. So you do have to stage or at least open things up to the public in a way that's safe and that everybody can come and enjoy themselves and still hear the candidates. And it's just sort of a necessary artifice of modern campaigns. And there are also moments for just real kind of, you know, spontaneous, just really warm, heartening moments. And those are the ones that I really look back to on the campaign.
Hey, Charlie Pierce, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to be on.
Charlie Pierce is a consultant with Pathfinder.gop, currently consulting with the Chris Christie campaign. He's worked on advanced teams for the John McCain and Mitt Romney presidential campaigns. For more stories with Charlie, including what it's like to overrule a presidential candidate on his hairstyle and how to steal a tie from Mitt Romney, visit thetakeaway.org.
Howler, ay Erbil.
This travel video is enthusiastically recommending that tourists come to Erbil, visit Kurdistan. With a gleaming city just west of the Zab River, the people of Kurdistan find themselves quite by surprise to be the envy of the crumbling, war-torn Middle East that was once the center of the Ottoman Empire. With the help of U.S. forces, Kurds have managed to thrive in the north of Iraq, holding back ISIS in the west and maintaining peaceful relations with the Iranians to the east. Is this an unexpected golden age for the Kurds, who were denied their own nation after World War I when the European powers divided the spoils of that conflict to create modern Turkey, Syria, and Iraq? In the 1970s, during the Cold War, the U.S. made territorial promises to the Kurds, and then Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger abruptly betrayed those promises to pursue an alliance with the Shah of Iran. And we all know how that turned out. But the Kurds haven't forgotten their complicated history with the United States, and today, as U.S. air power and Kurdish soldiers are fighting together against ISIS and have significantly weakened ISIS's hold on the city of Mosul, can the Kurds trust that this alliance is for real? Veteran foreign correspondent Charles Glass traveled to the Kurdish and Arab Shiite front lines last fall for an article in this month's Harper's Magazine. He says the Kurds maintain a surprising optimism that these are the best of times.
To be fair to the Kurds, in many ways, the U.S. has guaranteed their semi-independence in the north. The no-fly zone from 1991 to 2003 allowed them to begin to build their state, which is now called the Kurdish Regional Government, an autonomous part of Iraq. And they're still relying on the U.S. to help them. However, right now, with the war against ISIS, the U.S. is helping them, but in a way that keeps them dependent on the U.S. That is, they can't move anywhere without U.S. airstrikes. The U.S. is not supplying them with the equipment that they need to fight independently. So that means that they have no protection against IEDs. They don't have the weapons to take out these suicide bombing trucks, armored trucks that ISIS sends against Kurdish positions to open them up. They don't have artillery. When I was there recently, all of the Kurdish military commanders were complaining of lack of supplies, lack of enough ammunition, and so forth. And they all believe it's so that the U.S. will keep them dependent, and they won't really be able to act against ISIS on their own. So they have U.S. special forces guiding some of their operations, and then they have U.S. air power clearing the ground for them when the U.S. is ready for them to make advances.
What capability do the Kurds have in fighting ISIS that's being restrained by the lack of equipment that you observed in their discussions with you?
Well, it means that it's very difficult for them to advance because ISIS is better armed. I mean, ISIS has the most up-to-date American weapons thanks to the fact that the Iraqi army abandoned them and they were able to take them. And also, ISIS is still receiving weapons, anti-tank weapons in particular, from Saudi Arabia. and it still receives ammunition through the Turkish border. So the Kurds are really outgunned. If they had the supplies that they need, they could fight very well and drive ISIS out of areas where Kurds are.
What's your assessment of the U.S. policy here? Is it a reaction to circumstances that the U.S. doesn't have the will to try to change? Or is there something nefarious at work here?
Probably both. I think that it began when the Arab Spring erupted in Syria in March of 2011, and the U.S. administration took the position that it would covertly arm and train Syrian rebels to overthrow the Syrian regime. And when that program began, most of the people who were willing to take up arms turned out to be jihadists who were not taking up arms because the Syrian government was undemocratic, which it was, but because it wasn't a Sunni fundamentalist government. Mm. So the U.S. helped to escalate the civil war. This created a vacuum in all of eastern Syria, which opened the way for the Islamic State of Iraq, as it was then called, to come in and then turning around and going back to Iraq where it came from and taking large parts of territory in Iraq, which then forced the U.S. to act because it was about to lose Erbil and Baghdad to this fanatic and very anti-American force created partly due to American policy.
You've described the U.S. policy as criminal.
I said it was either negligent or criminal in my article in Harper's Magazine, yes. And I think that it's criminal to treat the Kurds the way they've been treated. 90% of the Kurdish casualties are from IEDs. So what happens? They go into a town that they've driven ISIS out of, and ISIS has very effectively booby-trapped every building, every vehicle in the town. So they need young men to go in and dismantle those. And because they don't have the proper equipment to do it, they lose their limbs or they're killed. And I think that is criminal because these are people that are ostensibly American allies and who are acting under American direction, and they're not being given the protection. The U.S. would not let its own soldiers go and dismantle those bombs without the proper equipment.
There are a few American reporters with the kind of experience that you've had in Syria, seeing it at a time of peace amidst dictatorship, seeing it in conflict with the Israelis, seeing it in very different episodes of history. What's your assessment of what Syria could ever possibly be in this century?
I'm very pessimistic about what's happening in Syria. Because neither side has the strength to defeat the other, the war will go on and on. And the real problem for Syria is this war. And the existence of the war allows ISIS and similar groups to thrive. The war has to be stopped if anything good is going to come out of it. But much of the old Syria, and even under the dictatorship, there were good things in Syria. I mean, you lived amongst your neighbors. If you got involved in politics, you had real problems, as you do in any Arab state. The mistake that Syria made in the eyes of the United States and Israel was that it had a strategic alliance with Iran. And Assad, the father and the son, have relied on it to give it strategic depth in its dispute with Israel. The whole thing slightly came unglued when the U.S. did its own nuclear deal with Iran, and now American business wants to go back into Iran, and trading may well resume. So the raison d'etre for getting rid of Bashar is slightly gone, and I think that has left U.S. policy floundering ever since.
When you stand in Syrian territory or Iraqi territory and note the frontier that leads into ISIS territory, is that border solid? Is that border the kind of thing that is more tangible than the map lines drawn by Churchill, you know, at the end of World War I? Is it something that people are beginning to recognize that may have a permanence that is frightening?
Well, right now, there's about a 750-kilometer front line between ISIS and the Iraqi Kurds, and that is all now fortified. It's a huge land barrier built up with trenches below and barbed wire and trenches in front and landmines in front. The Kurds themselves still want to advance beyond that. But right now, that border is pretty solid.
Charles Glass, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Charles Glass is a Middle East reporter and author. You can read his latest piece, Disunified Front, on the Kurdish role in the fight against the Islamic State, in this month's Harper's Magazine. How many electronic adapters do you have in your home right now? Excuse me, let me rephrase that. How many landfills could you make out of the boxes of old outmoded adapters in your home right now? No, it's the 5-volt. I need the 6-pin, 20, 30-pin. What? RS. What is that? Oh, where did that thing go? Where did that thing go? Get ready, folks, because it's just possible that Apple, the killer of the FireWire and the RS-232 connector and maker of any number of power cords that no longer fit any Apple devices, Apple is rumored to be getting ready to write the obit on the little mini headphone jack. Leander Caney is editor and publisher of the blog Cult of Mac and author of Johnny Ive, the genius behind Apple's greatest products, and he says this is a good thing.
I remember there was huge howls of protest with the first iMac in the late 90s when it didn't have a floppy drive. People said that that was going to be doomed because people wouldn't buy a computer that they couldn't use their old floppies with. And it happened with the first iPhone because it didn't have a physical keyboard like the Palm Pilot and the BlackBerry. People said that no one would buy an iPhone without a keyboard. I mean, who would want it? Who would want a phone without a keyboard? If you look back on it, they've actually done us a huge favor.
Well, and there are landfills all over the world filled with Palm Pilots attest precisely what you're saying. And the fact that there are billions and billions of devices that still use the mini jack is no real power that Apple needs to worry that much about. Yes or no?
Well, there's going to be a huge outcry. There's going to be the howling of biblical proportions about it because, like you say, this is one of the oldest outstanding connections, and there are millions, maybe hundreds of millions of headphones that will be rendered obsolete overnight. Actually, that's probably not true because they'll probably include an adapter.
Oh, you think?
Most definitely, yeah.
Some company in Bangalore will come up with an adapter.
Oh, everyone will come up with an adapter, yeah. Although it's a very sophisticated connection. So, this is why Apple charges so much for their cables. You know, they're famous for charging $60, $70, $80 for what seems like a simple wire. But they're actually, include some very sophisticated chips and circuitry. So, you'll be able to get cheap knockoffs, but they probably won't be very good.
But it is the case that the old mini jack doesn't have a whole lot of signal there. I mean, there's not a lot of complexity to the signal. And in many ways, there are limitations. That jack becomes a bottleneck.
Exactly, yeah. Apple's doing us a favor by forcing us to move on to something newer. I mean, it dates back to the 1880s. It was the original, it was in the old telephone switchboards. It was the jack that the operators used to use to switch phone calls. And then Sony miniaturized it in the 50s with the transistor radio. So this dates back, to the 50s and 60s, the 3.5-millimeter jack as we know it today. And yeah, it does very limited things.
I mean, it's the case that since Bluetooth, we didn't necessarily need any connectors at all for any of the audio offline devices that go along with our digital phones and digital computers, correct?
Right, absolutely. And of course, that may be the next step. Apple might be getting rid of the Lightning connector too, if it moves to wireless charging. You already have wireless charging in the Apple Watch. If they bring that to the phone, it's conceivable that they will have no wires coming out of it at all. But I think, what they're doing is that Apple has long led the technology industry, and they see that to move on, you've got to jettison some of the old stuff. And they're, one of the least conservative companies. I mean, if it was left up to, some of the other PC manufacturers, we'd still be using serial ports and old, those big old printer ports, and every computer would have every single connection on it that you can imagine. And so I think it's a trade-off that's worth making. It's inconvenient in the short term if there are things that you're used to doing, if you have an old printer or something like that you can't connect up wirelessly. But in the long term, this is the way that technology works and the way it should work.
Well, the three A's of modern technology, Apple produces anxiety, produces an opportunity for the adapter industry.
Right.
Some things never change. Leander, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Leander Caney is editor and publisher of the blog Cult of Mac and author of Johnny Ive, the genius behind Apple's greatest products. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.